The Unpublished Podcast with Amy and James.
Hi everyone, welcome to The Unpublished Podcast. This week we are doing a bit of authory writing business. We're talking about something in the publishing industry, which has gone viral. It's doing the rounds. You might have seen the article. There was an article that came out the other day, I think about a week ago, and it was called No One Buys Books by L. Griffin.
No One's Buys Book.
No One's Buys Book by L. Griffin. And it was basically just L had gone through the big 2022 Penguin Random House antitrust trial in America. So Penguin Random House wanted to acquire Simon & Schuster. So Penguin Random House, the biggest publisher, wanted to acquire Simon & Schuster, a very large publisher, but a smaller player in the out of the big five. It's one of the smaller players. Anyway, Elle went through the transcript of this trial where, you know, the Department of Justice in the US were asking a lot of industry questions.
And the DOJ obviously was very ignorant as to what the publishing industry was like.
Yeah, so they talked to them through it from first principles, and the parts of the trial that Elle has extracted make it look very dire for the publishing industry. And I think it plays to this narrative going around, which we see a lot, that all the arts are dying.
Yeah.
That no one's buying anything from
artists
anymore.
No one buys books. No one wants the arts.
And I mean, we wanted to just use this as a way to kind of counteract that narrative, speak to that narrative, speak to it from there. And then there's another side to the argument, which we're also going to be referencing, where there are two other great articles that counter this argument, which we'll be drawing from. And one of them is Yes, People Do Buy Books by Lincoln Michael. And another one is People Buy Books, Publishing is Thriving, and Substack Will Never Replace Books by Brooke Warner. We will link to all of those in the show notes if you want to read them yourself. They're all very interesting. It's a very interesting debate to read play out online.
Yeah, and it's happening right now, which I think is exciting. I think particularly I've seen a lot of it on Threads. Threads has been a really interesting space, like book threads, publishing threads. I mean, it gets catty. It's really catty, actually. But you see a lot of like these conversations play out.
And something I wanted to say before we start is that obviously the main trial referenced is with Penguin Random House. Amy does have a book coming out with Penguin Random House.
I do.
So if we seem like where publishing industry stands, you know, we are obviously writers, so we want publishing to do well, but just to let you know.
I think it's going to be a very nuanced conversation.
I think it is too, but just to let you know that we do have a professional relationship with Penguin Random House, in case that in any way colours how you
how
think
we speak about it.
Speak about it.
Yeah.
So, Amy, what did you find interesting about the article No One Buys Books?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of, obviously, criticism on this article, and I think rightfully so. I think the biggest problem is that she's looking at a trial that was Penguin Random House desperately trying to look like they were an industry going under, because that would have allowed them to buy Simon & Schuster, which in the end did not happen.
Yeah, because if Penguin look weak, then they go, well, there's no problem if we buy Simon & Schuster, we're still weak.
Yeah.
So why don't you just let us buy Simon & Schuster anyway?
Yeah, so they were presenting evidence very much, and I'm not saying anything was untrue, but it was like the evidence they presented was definitely to work with a narrative that was saying we would never become
a monopoly.
A monopoly, because the publishing industry is going down the toilet.
Yeah, so we need to compete so hard
all
the time for sales anyway. So, you know, please just let us buy Simon & Schuster.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, the Department of Justice didn't let them buy.
Said,
no, you can't buy Simon & Schuster. Simon & Schuster ended up getting sold to a private equity firm, which I don't see
again,
how that's
like,
any better.
Again, like, what the
better.
Fuck, yeah.
But
it is better, I think, because you don't, at least they're not we're not getting a big globular publishing industry.
And don't get me wrong, I don't want the big five to get any stronger.
No, I don't
for
want
writers.
Either.
I don't think that would be any better
no,
for writers.
No, it's not useful. It's not useful for them either, I don't think. Like, I feel like it's not going to solve the publishing house problems.
And also, this is where this needs to be said, is that these are huge businesses. And I think this is where, like, the first point where you start to see cracks in this argument that these are, you know, the publishing industry is feeble, no one's buying books, is that this is a $30 billion industry.
Mm-hmm.
$30 billion of books are sold every single year,
mm-hmm.
and they're quite profitable, these companies.
Yeah.
Like, they are not doing poorly. Like, the owners are not doing poorly for these companies. They are big, big business,
mm-hmm.
And they're doing actually quite well.
Yeah.
And the idea that books are in decline, I think when you actually look at the data, which is what we're going to be doing in a second, I think, is just false.
It's just not true,
You can spin the narrative in a lot of different ways, and the Elle has picked out various parts of the argument to make the argument
seem
look
like that.
Worse. Yeah.
Which is because Penguin Random House were trying to do that in this trial.
Yeah, and do you want to go into it?
I was going to say, why don't I just go through some of the points that I pulled out from Zoe's article, you know, that are very that or what Penguin Random House essentially presented in this
Zoe,
trial.
Who is Zoe in this situation?
L. That's weird.
It is weird. Do we know a Zoe who works in publishing?
No.
No. Okay, L, go on.
Zoe? Excuse me. So these are some of the bigger things that I just kind of pulled out from Zoe/L's article. She talks about how publishing houses spend most of their money on celebrity book advances, and that's where they make their money. So from these big celebrity...
Or lack of their money. Or lack of money.
Yeah. Or yeah, exactly. But really, yeah, let me get there, James. There's so much to discuss in this conversation. And that they make their money through these big buys and through like selling the Bible, selling Lord of the Rings, selling these backlist that are perennial sellers. And she was saying that this is basically where their income comes in. But she's saying that all other books are essentially what she calls a vanity project. So she's saying that unless you are one of these big names or you are in a perennial bestseller, like whoever wrote the Bible and J.R.R. Tolkien's estate, yeah, that books basically just aren't making money. That's what she's saying. She says that most other books sell less than 1,000 copies, which is 96% of published books, is what she says. She goes on to say that bestsellers are so rare that the publishing industry seems more like venture capitalists, betting and risking their income on certain books, and just seeing whether it plays out. And I think Penguin in that trial did say that they see themselves as angel investors in authors. So they pick, and I kind of see that play out, definitely. They see, it's much more risk, more of a risk game than like an actual game where they have a huge amount of strategy. Is that unfair to say?
I mean, I guess if you believe that, if you believe Elle's take on it, I think you would say that, yeah.
But I think maybe I do believe that part of it, that it's a lot more of like a venture capitalist kind of structure.
I mean, of course, it is impossible to tell which project is going to do well. But if you look at one of the competing articles, one of the other side, Lincoln Michael's article, Yes, People Do Buy Books, he lays it out that, Elle is saying that most books don't make back their money, don't make back their advance, which is actually a skewed way of looking at it, because she's saying books that don't make back their advance are unprofitable for publishers, and that isn't true.
Okay, would you like to do very slowly, because it's very hard to understand, explain how authors get paid and how publishers get paid?
Okay, sure.
In a traditional publishing model.
Say your book is accepted by a big five publisher, and they offer you $10,000 to write your book.
Yes.
That is an advance, usually paid to you in 3 or 4 installments over... from when you sign, and then it's often one when you hand in the document and one when it's published, and then a year after that. It would be a very traditional basic structure for an advanced structure. So you might get $2,500 on payment one, payment two, payment three, and payment four. Now,
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that? Before you signed?
I understood right now because we're in that. But before we signed, I didn't realize that the payment was split out over 4 payments. And especially the 1 year after the book comes out. Yeah, it's wild.
And you will never earn another cent until you pay the publisher back for that.
Yeah.
Now, where it gets interesting is you are paying the publisher back based on your royalty agreement.
Royalty rate, yeah.
So every book you sell, 10 to 12.5% of your sale goes towards paying back your royalty.
So it's not the whole book sale that goes back to paying your royalty.
So it might have, the publisher has some costs, but they still can be profitable on a book sale because they're taking back after the retailer and the cost of distribution. They're still taking maybe $10 on a $20 book. And $1 of that is going back to the, or $2 of that is going back to the author and going towards paying back your advance.
Yeah.
But they're still taking $8 on that, for example. Yeah, I don't know the exact numbers.
Yeah, so you can be profitable before the author gets their royalties.
Yes, because so they're not dum-dums. Like, they're not giving you $10,000 and like, they're like, well, we're only going to be profitable once you're profitable too. It's no. They want to make their money back way earlier than that. So actually about 50% of books make money for the publisher.
Yes. Fewer earn out their advance. I think there was
10 or 15% or something.
Earn out their advance.
Yeah, so 15% ever pay back their advance to the publisher, but 50% of books for the publisher are profitable.
And in that way, that's why I think it feels like venture capitalism, because it's like, it's still like 50-50. Like it isn't as real, it isn't as risky as like what people do.
Well, 50-50 is way better than venture
capital. Yeah, you're right.
50-50 is pretty good. Like 50-50 on a business decision for us is good, I think. Like
most
businesses generally fail. So it's not just venture capital. Yeah, like 90% of businesses fail. So
a
business that's able to say they make money from 50% of their bets is not actually bad. And it's not like they're making only... And not like they're breaking even there because, like, well, 50% fail and 50% are profitable. It's like, because then the ones that win are winning so big that, like, they don't need any more than 50% to be. And as I said before, you can look, all their financials are available online. Just Google it. Like, these are very profitable businesses. They're making money.
Yeah.
Making a lot of money. Yeah. And it's not just from the backlist and it's not just from big celebrities, is the other thing as well.
Yeah. Would you like to speak to that?
Yeah. So. And we will talk about indie books later, but we're just talking about the big five right now and the big publishers right now. But essentially, you know, and this is once again drawing from Lincoln's article, Lincoln is saying that the big presses, they're not dum-dums as well. Like they're not, you know, the Elle's article implied that the average book sells 12 copies in a year, which is which is a false statistic because if I can just do a sidebar quickly to explain why that's wrong. Is
in Baby the, love statistics.
In the trial, they're referencing what is the average book of all the books published sell in a calendar year. You know, they're including their sample books from the 1800s there, that you know, niche medical texts from the 1800s. Like, of course that book's going to sell zero in a year.
Yeah.
So putting that into the average is almost pointless.
Yeah.
Like, it's pointless.
It's like how they took out the Obamas. On the other end of the spectrum, they had to take out the Obama's book statistics because it was such an anomaly.
But they didn't take out...
But they didn't take out the things that are selling nothing.
And also includes, you know, crossword books. It includes...
Yeah. Colouring in books that never sell.
John has... I think the example he uses in the article is, you know, someone's grandpa who's like, oh, it'd be great to just publish self-publish a book for my kids, so that my grandkids, so they can read it. I'm not intending to sell it in any way. Like, is it weird that that book only sells two or three copies? Like, they're not trying to sell it.
That's the intention, yeah.
That's the intention. So all these things are included in the sample. In reality... Most books, a big five publisher probably isn't going to buy a book that they don't think will sell at least 5,000 to 10,000 copies, which I don't know, it might not seem like a lot of money to you, but a lot of copies to you, but that's still.
Also, I thought this whole conversation is bizarre because like, why is 5 to 10,000 print copies of books not incredible and beautiful and 10,000 people reading these books and enjoying these books? Like, why is that not worth it? Why should we, and this is what Elle suggests, that we should, Elle says don't write books. Right on Substack. And it's like, why?
Okay, so I did my own original research on this.
Oh, you did?
To counteract that claim. Because she's like, well, I'm so happy I'm on Substack and not writing a book. It's like, there are only... Sorry, I've written it down here. Let me just check my notes. There are... Oh, I got to find it. Thank you for singing to keep up. Oh, I've lost my notes here. If I could just sum up what I... think I read is that there are 2 million paid subscriptions on Substack, total 2 million paid subscriptions on Substack between 17,000 writers. So that's 117 paying people per writer on Substack. So that 5,000 book, 10,000 books makes that 117 look
nothing.
Like nothing.
And that's not to say Substack is an incredibly exciting space.
Of course, it's much newer. It's much smaller. Yeah. People don't know about it. There are 10x,
but just 20 million people. It just seems like an unnecessary thing to say.
It's ridiculous.
And books, I think it might be Brooke Warner, the second article we referenced. Like, she's like, books are a different medium. Like, they're where we code to consume at length. Like, you know, they're where we take time away from screens. They're like, you know, they're a very different format.
And they start conversations. They're where they're like the intellectual bedrock of our society.
Yes.
They are often ahead of the curve on a lot of the ideas that end up getting put into pop culture and into the public consciousness. Like, they're really important beyond just how many sales they make. They're incredibly important. And not to say that Substack isn't also important.
No, it's incredibly just important. Different. It's just different, yeah.
You don't write long 60, 70, 80,000 Substack articles.
No.
So you just can't go into the same kind of depth that you can go into in a book. Like, it's an important industry for that sort of thing.
Obviously, super biased, we're authors, but, like, I fucking love books. Like, as I was reading this article, I was looking around and thinking about how many books I read and how many books the people I love read and just, like, how important books are. And I was like, it doesn't read. this article doesn't read.
I think the other interesting thing about the publishing industry is that print sales of books, print sales have remained constant or are actually rising. Like, fiction books... More fiction books were sold this year than last year. It's slightly down on nonfiction, but a lot of this stuff can be explained by, you know, oh, the new Sarah J. Maas book came out this year and yeah. she didn't release one last year or something.
I think also the numbers were a little skewed with that post-COVID. Like, there was a really big uptick for 2021.
Yeah, so it looks like a decline from 21 to 22, but 24 is still way above 2019.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. We're reading more.
We're reading more. And yeah. then that's print book sales, which everyone said was die. So it doesn't even include ebooks and audiobooks, which is massive. Like, from our perspective, we sell way over half of our books, our ebook or audio.
Yeah.
I would say it would be 70 to 80% of our books. Now, that's not the same for everyone.
Yeah.
But we sell 70 to 80% of our books. So yeah. It's just crazy. Like, to not
consider that.
Yeah, please. Everything's going up. It's like number go up. And yes, there are more books published every year, but that still shows that the appetite for books is growing. It continues to grow. And there's no sign of it slowing down. Like, the book industry is actually in a great place right now in terms of lifetime sales.
Yeah, definitely. I loved, I think it might have been Brooke who shared the 2023 top 25 bestsellers, and 19 of those were fiction.
Exactly.
And I thought that was so exciting. I love this idea that we're moving into like this really like story obsessed culture. I mean, we've always been obsessed with stories, but I love that. Like, fiction is so prevalent in that top.
And you can just
25.
See what's happening on TikTok, you know.
People want stories.
And YouTube as well. It's a lovely story. I'm reading a series at the moment called, the first book is Empire of Silence by Christopher Rocchio. And this is a book that was a science fiction book, absolutely languished for the first 6 or 7 years of its life. Was that with Door, which is a decent-sized press, but they didn't back it very hard. I think he was about to get dropped by his publishers. And a couple of YouTubers picked it up, and now it's like, flying off the shelves.
Incredible.
Everything was out of stock. They're reprinting it, giving him special editions. They've kept it alive. Like, he's going to be able to finish the series.
Mm.
And this is something that would not have happened, you know, like 20 years ago.
No, it's so exciting. You know, this is a really shifting industry. And I think it is exciting. Like, if you want to, you know, get informed, figure it out. Like, there's space to move here. And there's definitely a lot to criticize about how the system is working, because it's obviously not working like at its best right now. But I also think that gives us room to like figure out how we want to do it, because there is room for us to do it on our own now.
Yeah, definitely. And something else I wanted to say was, Brooke,
okay.
I thought you were done.
I said I'm open my mouth to speak, but I want you to go.
Oh, well, I many apologies, Amy.
Accepted.
This might not be relevant to you, so I apologize. I was going to say, Brooke Warner, I believe, owns a kind of hybrid / indie publishing house, like a small press. And she gave the financials for her press. And she said the press earned $1 million and they grossed $345,000. So
beautiful.
They earned $1 million, but obviously it cost them about $700,000 to operate, or $650,000 to operate their business. But then at the end of that, after all those operating expenses, there was $345,000 gross left over at the end, which, okay, $345,000, that's a lot of money. Like,
man, if I'm grossing that, I'm feeling good.
I know, right? Like, that's a good business.
Yeah,
a good
great business.
That's at the end, after their costs of bringing in $345,000. Like,
we always want to think of things in such huge scale, and if they're not massive scale, they're not successful or not worth it. Like, shut the fuck up.
And I think something about Elle's article is she was poo-pooing these people making $300,000. Like, these books that sell 300,000 copies. She's like, publishers love these books that sell only 300,000 copies. I'm like, what world are you living
in? And also, that was per year. 300,000 copies per year.
It's like, that's... You know, if you times that by 20, what is that? Like $6 million?
It's crazy.
Why? In what world? As I just said, there are only 2 million paid subscriptions on Substack. So I'm so sorry. Like, in what world is 300,000 copies of a book a small amount?
Yeah, really bizarre.
And, you know, even someone who's selling 300,000 books a year is not only making a living, they're making a very, very,
a
very
beautiful
good living.
Fucking living, yeah.
Someone, I don't know this for sure, but someone selling 50,000 books, I'm sure, is making quite a good living.
Yeah. Yeah.
On their books.
A load of books.
Yeah. Maybe we're making $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
Say? Like, that's, I'm so sorry.
Lovely.
Is that a bad living by your standards, L?
Yeah. Interesting.
It's interesting.
I know another thing that was interesting about Elle's article was the kind of part where she went into, and I mean, this has been a really big conversation on Threads again, like marketing and like the marketing budget that publishers will put behind authors.
I noticed that too.
So it was kind of like a strange tangent, but it was interesting, I guess.
Well, I think what it showed was, because she mentioned, I think it was, I can't remember which publisher was talking about Colleen Hoover.
I've got it here. It's Jonathan Karp, CEO of Simon & Schuster.
There you go.
It says, question, who is the best-selling Simon & Schuster author currently? The answer was, right now it's Colleen Hoover. Does she have the highest marketing budget that Simon & Schuster pays? No. Why is that? She's the queen of TikTok, and so she has a huge following on TikTok, was his answer.
Which to me doesn't show that book publishing is dying. It shows that authors have an amazing
opportunity.
Colleen Hoover wasn't the queen of TikTok before her books blew up.
That's true. She's built this.
On the back of her books that have done really well. You know, it's not like she built that platform first. And what's that saying? What that's saying is that publishers, yes, they might not be devoting hundreds of thousands of dollars to market your book, but that's because we're in a very different environment now. Like, you can kind of just seed a book in many ways and watch it fly if it takes off on TikTok or YouTube.
Mm.
It doesn't have to, you know, what's the point of a billboard these days?
I don't know. Yesterday, we were in London and Taylor Swift has a fucking massive billboard. I'm like,
on Brick
is
Lane.
This selling?
Like, what are you putting a giant billboard on Brick Lane for?
I guess she just has a lot of money. It doesn't matter.
I guess. But also, it's like, these are the things that are such a waste of time, you know? Mm. Like, why would anyone want someone to be spending hundreds of thousands of dollars getting you onto daytime TV shows or getting you on a billboard or getting a print magazine ad for you? It's like, that's just pointless to me.
I mean, maybe it isn't, though.
But it's an inefficient use of money. So, of course, they're not going to be doing that.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So it's like, yeah, budgets have gone down, but it's because... it's just cheaper to, I think it's just cheaper to market now.
Yes. I mean, I also think there is obviously, like, you speak to a lot of authors who feel extraordinarily let down by publishing houses because there is now more of an expectation that the...
It's always been the case. Like,
yeah, I stopped myself.
I've been hearing stories since I've known about the industry, which is, say, like, for a decade I've been paying attention to the industry. I feel like people have been complaining. And then I feel like these people who are complaining are often people who were in the industry in the 90s and didn't get... and felt like they weren't supported enough by their publishing house. So it's like,
yeah.
I just feel like it's not a new thing. It's just
I guess it's like now they're much more obviously searching for people who have platforms, and social media is like such a bigger part of it now. Mm. It feels much more, feels much more on the onus of the author to market themselves. And so you get a lot of stories of really disenchanted and bitter artists who feel really let down by their publishing house because they haven't had this big marketing budget. And I think, I mean, it's really complicated. And obviously, like, I honor people's pain, and it's really hard to negotiate and navigate a relationship with such huge business, especially if it's a big five and you're just a single author. You can feel so small. But again, I mean, I'm always going to take this premise of, like, it's your job to back your work. And it's always been the artist's job to back their work. It has always been the creative's job to ship their art before anyone else ships it. And so... I know that's hard, but I really think it's an innate part of being an artist that people just resent, and I have issue with that.
I agree.
I'm not saying it's not hard. It is fucking hard. I really want to say something else.
Go for it, Emma.
Again, like, I wasn't entirely sure where she was going with this, but I thought it was really interesting. Having a lot of social media followers or fame, says Elle, doesn't guarantee it will sell. The singer Billie Eilish, despite having 97 million Instagram followers and 6 million Twitter followers, sold only 64,000 copies within 8 months.
I mean, I have a lot to say about this.
Of publishing her book.
First of all, of course, because, like, what makes you think that Billie Eilish's followers are book readers? Like, there's no crossover there. So it's like, yeah, well, maybe they should be targeting people who... probably have an audience that are book readers.
They would have paid us such a fucking bomb for it as well.
Obviously a terrible idea. The other thing is that Billie Eilish doesn't care. So, like, Billie Eilish probably I don't know this for a fact, but I would bet that Billie Eilish has never spoken publicly about that book. Maybe on launch day.
I've never heard about it. Maybe on launch day. Right now.
Like, I just think that a lot of it
sometimes
depends on
that. Think about how Kylie and Kendall Jenner wrote a fiction book together.
Interesting.
I know. I
wonder how it went.
I did not go well.
This is something else that's interesting that I was going to say, and something that's getting me down about this conversation. And a lot of people are angry about this article from Elle. And I would say that we fall into that category potentially.
We do, or we don't?
Not angry about it, but just think it was a disappointment that it went so viral.
You know, she just skewed the data in a way that wasn't, I don't think, really helped the conversation. Yeah. I also wasn't entirely sure of her intentions behind it, because at the end of the conversation, I left feeling like she was trying to say, don't write books.
Yeah, well, apparently she's a big proponent of Substack, so it's kind of in her interest to...
I don't love that conclusion. Like, I like the discussion that, you know, I want to have discussions about how publishing needs to change, because it does.
Hmm.
And we've always said that. And I like the conversation about, like, you know, how to market and where to put your budget and all this kind of stuff. I like this conversation. I like challenging these things because it is a shifting space. But to conclude after all of that with some sketchy statistics, not to write books, I'm obviously going to be pissed.
I mean, we're internet people, you know. We love internet. We're all about... building your audience with short, pithy things. But to say that we don't need books is to say that everything should be condensed down into 100, 200, 500, 1,000 word things. Like, there's no value to long form anymore. There's such a huge value to long form. Like, people still love long form.
And I guess the other reason why we're angry is because don't say people don't buy books.
Exactly. What I've been trying to get at is if you go down to the comments of Elle's article, and I actually first heard about Elle's article on, there's a booktuber I follow called Daniel Green, and he does a fantasy news segment every week. And he mentioned it in his fantasy news segment. And if you go into the comments of Daniel's video, if you go into the comments of Elle's videos, it's a lot of writers being like, oh, I'm just going to give up then.
No.
Yeah, being like, well, what's the point?
You know, the problem is that, like, you see this when I get upset and fiery. The problem is that there's such a fucking strong scarcity narrative in this community. And so don't write shit like this, because it feeds directly into this belief that we are forever going to be in pain and that writers are never going to be able to succeed. We're always going to be poor. What's the point? What's the point? And I can't with that narrative. And I can't with the writers who are absolutely, and it goes over the border of writers. It goes into so many different artistries, but writers are so fucking prone to it, to thinking, oh, well, what's the fucking point? And there's so much point, and that really upsets me, James. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's just a lot of people being like, well, I'm giving up, or, well, I'm not even going to try. And it's like, so what did the article achieve then? It just sort of made everyone feel demoralized and shit. But the thing is, because it's emotive, it's going to get a lot of views, and it did get a lot of views. And then that's going to become, availability bias is going to kick in. People are going to remember that one article, and they'll be like, well, publishing is dying.
Yeah, and you're going to get false statistics flying left, right, and center.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish that, I mean, I'm so grateful for these other authors who have done these, not retaliation pieces, but
rebuttals.
But they're never going to go as viral, unfortunately, because they're not as pithy and they're not as, like, I mean, her fucking title was
No One Buys Books.
No One Buys Books, which again, it's just like, oh, I knew that no one ever buys books. It's just, it feeds into this stupid fucking narrative that so many of us have. And I, it's not a lot of our, like, it's not always our fault that we think this way, because it's so saturated in the culture, and it's like almost like a inheritance from, like, our writer lineage, but it's not true, and it's our job to change it.
And the only thing that this attitude does is helps the big five publishers or the gatekeepers, it helps them be able to justify their decisions not to back smaller authors.
Ew.
You know? Even though what these big companies should be doing is backing smaller authors that have something interesting to say, because those are the surprise books that, honestly, they can pay a smaller advance to.
Yes.
And they can get bigger rewards out of. And it's like, I think, obviously, it looks good for people in publishing to be able to go, you know, their boss goes, what books did you acquire this year? And they go, well, Britney Spears. And that's a bad example, because Britney Spears' book did really well, I think.
Really well, yeah.
But, or say Billie Eilish's, and like, oh, I know who the Billie Eilish is. Obviously, you're doing a good job. Whereas if they say, oh, I bought Amy McNee's book, which, and to be clear, we did very well from our publishing advance.
We did incredibly well.
I'm in no way complaining about that. And also, we've had a really great experience with them so far. So I don't want to complain about that in any way. I'm not targeting our experience in any way. But it's like, if they go say, we signed Amy McNee, their boss is going to be like, who the hell is that?
Yeah.
And if it was someone with fewer followers, then say it was, you know, someone who had no following as well, they're going to go,
James Weinstock.
Yeah, James Weinstock. Who the hell is that? So I think the best thing we can do is trying to start a narrative that not only do people want to buy books, that they want to buy books from people who don't necessarily have a name. Like, they want to buy books that have good ideas. And that's a final, I don't know, maybe final point. I don't know how close to wrapping up we are.
I don't know either.
But something I've been wanting to, I keep forgetting to say, is that in fiction, I feel like there's very little evidence that they're only going for famous people in fiction.
No, they're not.
Exactly.
I don't see that at all.
You know, it's just a different beast.
Because fiction? It's exactly. I mean, look at Kylie and Kendall Blossom. Like, it's incredibly, I mean, I don't even know if they wrote it or if they had a ghostwriter write it. But, like, telling stories is such a skill, and not everyone's here to be a fiction author. And so if you have a big following, or if you have, I don't know, it's just like they don't match up necessarily. Whereas I feel like you can get, you know, an influencer to write a nonfiction book. You know, maybe they need to get a bit of support from a ghostwriter or someone to support them along the way, and it can sell. But if you get a random influencer to try and write a murder mystery, it's just less likely.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, if you look at the print book sales, it looks like nonfiction does sell better in bookstores, because that's what essentially, and I guess on Amazon, but print book sales is essentially a proxy for bookstores, I would say. So, like, adult nonfiction in 2023, and this is from Lincoln's article, sold 284 million copies of nonfiction books in print, and adult nonfiction sold 190 million books. That's in print. Now, fantasy, science fiction, romance, and crime all sell better in ebooks, like more better than 50-50 in ebooks. So you have to imagine, and I can't imagine that very many nonfiction books sell better in ebook and Audible than.
Oh, I always listen to my nonfiction.
I know you do, but I think a lot of
But you're an anomaly.
I think you are an anomaly for because it's very clear that certain genres and certain readers prefer audio and ebook. So I wouldn't be surprised if those numbers balance out over time as well. So it's like fiction is a huge part of the market, and that huge part of the market is serviced largely by unknowns. People who are, you know, don't have a huge profile before they sell their book.
Yeah, interesting.
And that's still the case.
Yeah, really interesting. Do we have anything to discuss in terms of like indie publishing and self-publishing that came out of this?
I mean, it's just absolutely apparent that all those areas are absolutely booming.
Yeah.
You know, they're up massively. So the big five do feel scared of indie publishing.
Yeah, I felt like you could feel that.
And they're scared of different models. Like they're really scared of, a big thing that came out in the trial is they're really scared of Kindle Unlimited.
Yeah, they're really scared of Kindle Unlimited.
And subscription products, which I think is ridiculous because it shows how short-sighted they are. Because
I know, like, what are you doing?
You know, the amount of people who... So, Amy, we're not on Kindle Unlimited because if you go on Kindle Unlimited, you're not allowed to sell your book anywhere else. Amazon traps you if you go on Kindle Unlimited, which is why a lot of indie authors don't go on Kindle Unlimited. Mm. And so Kindle Unlimited, for those of you who don't know, is basically you pay $9.99 a month and you get unlimited access to any book on Kindle Unlimited. Now, we don't use that, but we use other things like Scribd and a lot of people, and you know, the library and Scribd, which are free book services essentially, unlimited book services, are so good for our other sales. The amount of people who go, I read your book from the library, I read your book on Scribd, and then I bought it.
Yeah, so beautiful.
It's like massively valuable to the industry. I think the idea that if we had some kind of like Netflix for books, it would ruin books is ridiculous because it's a bad analogy because Netflix, you watch a show on Netflix, what are you going to do? Go buy the Blu-ray?
Mm.
No. Like, but books have a different thing. Like, if you like it, you have a piece of art you can then go and display in your home to show people, oh, I like this thing. And it's very popular with books to do that.
Someone left me a review and it was 3.5 and they kind of averaged, regrettably, but then they were like, but I'm buying the book because I like, they had read it, they had listened to it, I think. And then at the end of this like mild review, they were like, but I'm going to buy the book because I like the cover.
Shout out to Lena,
Shout out to Lena Yang, my beautiful cover designer.
She who did such an amazing job on the book. And honestly, so many people have found the book, not because of any, but because of the cover.
Yeah, and the title.
And I think that it's incredibly helpful.
The indie space is so exciting.
More people are making money than ever from books. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, a fact. A lot of it that is because of the indie space.
Yeah, yeah. I just think it's so exciting. And
You know, we'll make like $1,500 just from our audiobook sales last month. I would say.
That's so cool.
And that is largely organic.
Yeah, we don't do shit about that.
Just because, I think because so few indie books do go audio.
Yeah.
Or maybe 1,000. I don't know. It's hard to know what the numbers really are.
Yeah.
That's just like kind of passive in the background, you know, 15 months from launch.
Mm. Oh, yeah. So
and
beautiful.
It's just because people are going through the Audible apps and going, that looks good. That looks good. That looks good. So nice.
So incredible.
And that's just something that wouldn't have happened 20, 30 years ago.
I guess like I just want to conclude saying that like there are issues and you know and there are problems, like, you know, me and James are always going to be we're not skeptical, but we're curious and about these gatekeepers and about publishing, but I also feel innately hopeful for authors in general.
I agree. I think it's actually quite an exciting time to be an artist.
I think it's an incredibly fucking... I think there's been no better time to be an author or an artist.
I know there are issues. I mean, when I look at the music industry, I think there are some horrible structural issues there.
Yeah.
Largely because the big three publishers, the big three, what do you call them? Labels. Are fucking dog shit.
Yeah.
And they're, in my view, basically like illegal, horrible, allegedly illegal monopolies that are just... need to basically be blown up. Mm-hmm. Not physically, I'm not condoning violence, I'm saying blown up metaphorically. Mm. And same goes for places like Ticketek, which just have like, I think, 70 to 80% of the market share of ticket sales, which is just absolutely horrible. It's just musicians get really, a really, really bad deal, and I feel sorry. I really feel for you. I'm sorry. I can't speak
to that. We don't know enough.
We don't know enough.
Yeah.
But I think...
we should get Chris on the pod.
Writing is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited.
Oh, and that's actually one other thing that Elle didn't cover in the article. And I think it was, I can't remember if it was Lincoln or if it was Brooks' article, but they were saying that it completely discounts when Elle says, oh, you know, these people are only making this much money from book sales. It completely discounts the fact that foreign rights and movie rights are massive for the book industry.
Ah, yes, she didn't think about rights at all.
Are massive for these companies, yeah. And for authors. And that's just like totally left out of the whole discussion, yeah. From Elle's article.
Super interesting.
Really important piece of the pie, piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. What did you say before that? I felt like I had something to say. Oh, no, I know what I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen Schmidt, who is a she's a publicist, a book publicist. She also wrote an article on this. And I've been following her on Threads, and I feel that she is sassy but poignant, wrote quite an emotional piece about how a lot of the times these articles really just affect people who work in publishing, who are in general people who just love books.
Of course.
And I think we can often target, like, the editors and, like, you know, the publicists who really just want to get books out there.
And to be clear, these people are people who are having their budgets squeezed.
Oh, and they're getting fucked.
And they're getting fucked despite working for incredibly profitable,
yeah,
companies. And this is the other thing, is that publishers love this narrative that they're dying, because then they can go, oh, we can't pay editors well. Yeah. We can't pay our publishers, yeah, well. We can't, you know, there are no jobs. I'm so sorry. Like, you're going to have to work for minimum wage to do something that should be a very desirable job. And meanwhile, you know, the owners of these big corporations are bringing home tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, that's just completely fucked up. It doesn't make
sense, yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. Like, they want to keep as much money as possible for themselves. So it's in their interest to say that it's a declining industry.
Yeah, yeah. I think we have to be really skeptical.
Because the message isn't actually affecting their bottom line.
Yeah.
It's affecting the psychology around people who go for their jobs there, like, who are applying for their jobs and their salary expectations, and authors' payment and royalty expectations as well.
Mm. Just a little addition. I think something that bothers me, and again, like, I know this is a very complex and nuanced conversation, is when authors who make a living from this is pet peeve, Amy. Authors who make a living from their writing then go on and share this stuff. I'm like, then they think it's their responsibility to share the doom and gloom about how the industry is so fucked and horrible and how writers won't be able to make a living when they're making a living. And I've seen this narrative being shared mostly by full-time authors.
Yeah.
And it's so fucking annoying. Like, why you and why not them? Like, we should be rising together. And if you are, you know, blessed enough to have a full-time life, or even, you know, to be making money from your books, then, like, encourage others who want to do the same.
I think, you know, obviously there are sacrifices you need to make as an author. Obviously, it's not always easy, obviously.
No, I mean, it is a bit of a shit show.
But, you know, people who can't understand that there's such a huge difference between making, you know, a decent wage as an author and making a very good wage as someone in finance. Like, of course there's a trade-off. There might be a trade-off, but, like, one is, I would much rather make a decent wage as an author than a good wage as someone in finance.
I just can't articulate how much more they're so different.
Yeah. It's like, if you're, and I think this is something that, who says this? I think Ryan Holiday says this. It's like, if you went into the profession with the sole aim of making as much money as possible, you fucked up.
What are you doing?
You fucked up.
Why are you not in finance?
But that isn't to say that people can't make a living from these professions.
Exactly.
If all you wanted to do was make maximum money, why didn't you go into finance?
Do you know what's funny? I mean, you know, I just don't think anyone's going into the arts thinking, oh, I'm going
to
make a load of money.
But authors have to be like, oh,
yes. And the amount of time, don't go in it for the money. It's like, no fucking artist is going in this for the money. We're called.
We're desperately hopeful that we can make a living wage out of it, or a decent wage out of it.
You're not going to make any
And that
money.
We can feed ourselves and house ourselves and everything. Like, and then when it does happen, we're like, oh, but I'm not making $1 million.
Or, oh, look at this article.
Yeah,
that says books don't sell. What's the point?
And of course, I'm not saying that you should be happy if you're just getting by. I'm not saying that. I'm saying there are a lot of people out there who are not just getting by. There are a lot of people out there making good middle class incomes from the arts, and that should be celebrated.
Yes, and we should be talking about how that happens. We should be lifting each other up. We should be supporting anyone who wants to do that. You know, we go together.
And the more we big up the industries, the more we argue for their value, the better we will be remunerated as well.
Yes, I think the issue is like, if we big, do we have to big up? Like, obviously, like, let's go back to the music industry. Like, we don't really want to big up these fucking shit.
No, but we want to big up how much value the musicians bring in that industry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not how much value fucking Ticketek brings or fucking Universal brings, who are just essentially gross. Just massive cunts.
Amen. So sorry, let's leave it at that.
Apparently, I'm not allowed to say that. Americans really hate that word.
Australians.
It's like saying they're massive banana heads if you're an Australian. It's about the same level of offense. I'm really sorry for everyone.
Okay. Do we have any news? We still have a few tickets left for LA and San Fran.
And also, I just want to remind you guys that Amy's books are all on sale.
They are.
As in your fiction.
My fiction books are on sale.
Will be on sale soon. Will be pre-orderable soon.
Yeah.
And also, if you could please support the podcast, because, you know, the only way we grow is by you all telling your friends about us.
Yeah, I think that's worth kind of putting something behind, like, because there's no, like, algorithmic system that pushes podcasts, the only way we grow is through you.
You know, we're not part of a network. We're not part of some kind of, like, system. It's
obviously
just you guys.
We're pretty fucking average on social media with the podcast, so, but I am trying.
And all of you who do share, all of you who do sharing your stories, all of you who do tell your friends about us, all of you who leave a review, we are so grateful for.
Unbelievably thankful. Also, shout out to everyone who saw my post the other day that was a quote from one of the podcasts, and it was along the lines of, like, fucking cunt fuck, and I asked you to guess who it was, and now I get to announce that it was actually, you were all right, and it was me. Oh dear. All right. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for this conversation. Obviously, love to hear your thoughts and opinions on it. It's a big topic.
I'm sorry I said cunt.